I was in a coma for 6 weeks while the doctors told my wife I was going to die. When I woke up, she told me the most fantastic story. My team kept running the business without me. Freelancers reached out to my team and said, "We will do whatever it takes as long as Craig's in the hospital." I consider that the greatest accomplishment in my career. My name is Craig Andrews, and this is the Leaders and Legacies podcast, where we talk to leaders creating an impact beyond themselves. At the end of today's interview, I'll tell you how you can be the next leader featured on this show. Today, I want to welcome Ellie Portnoy. He is a serial entrepreneur and the co-founder and CEO of BackEngine.ai. It is a platform that helps B2B companies harness the voice of the customer with the power of AI. And we're going to talk about that, what that means, voice of the customer, and why it's important. Ellie previously built and sold ThinkNear and Sense360. He's a serial entrepreneur, just builds business after business. And he's also an executive fellow at the Harvard Business School. So if you think voice of the customer is important, you want to tune in. If you don't think it's important, you should listen because it is. We're going to get into that. Ellie, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. Excited to be here.
So first off, let's tackle the name. So when I looked at it, it looked like Eli. Because when folks are searching for you, they're going to be like, "How do you spell Ellie?" And it's E-L-I. So what's the backstory on that?
Yeah, I grew up in Mexico, and the spelling for Ellie was E-L-I. And then I moved out here, and I never changed it. And so about 95% of people call me Eli, and I take no offense to it. But you asked for the correct pronunciation, so it's Ellie.
Yeah. Now, where'd you grow up in Mexico?
Mexico City.
Never been, but I've heard, you know, some of the things that kind of challenge my thinking is I think of Mexico as being like hot. You know, I live in Texas, and I think of Mexico being kind of hot, maybe hotter than Texas.
It depends where in Mexico, but Mexico City is actually very, very high on the mountains. So it's the elevation basically keeps it almost Mediterranean weather-like. So it never gets too hot and it never gets too cold. It's actually quite wonderful.
Wow. When I saw something once that, you know, apparently a lot of folks in Mexico live up at altitude.
Yeah, because like if you think about the Rocky Mountains, like those stretch down all the way through Mexico. And so the majority of Mexico is on the mountains. It's there's a lot of mountainous terrain there. Mexico yeah. City is literally at a very high elevation, and that's 20-something million people.
Wow. What is the elevation?
I don't remember off the top of my head, but it's high.
Yeah. Well, one of the things I saw was kind of a limitation in Mexico is a lot of these major areas are in the mountains, and so it's hard to set up, you know, it's hard to get trains in and, it's hard to transport goods in Mexico.
The issue that I remember very vividly growing up there is pollution, because it's effectively in the mountains and it's like almost like a valley inside of the mountain. And so all the pollution from the city of 20-something million people would just get stuck in that area, and it wouldn't have ways to get past it. So yeah, the mountains definitely created a whole bunch of issues.
Now, obviously you speak with a very clean, natural American accent. What ages were you living in Mexico? How'd you end up with a nice American accent?
I shouldn't. It's my dad is American. And so from an early age, I started talking to him in English. And that I think that really numbed my accent. But it's a good question. I didn't start speaking English until I was 5, and I lived most of my childhood in Mexico, so I really should have an accent.
Wow. Wow. Well, what a valuable skill to be able to speak presumably fluent Spanish and English at the same time.
It's been helpful for sure.
Now, you have an employee. You were telling me earlier you have an employee in Brazil. How's your Portuguese?
Non-existent. I can maybe make out if it's in like written out, I can maybe make out what it's saying, but the spoken language, I can't at all.
Wow. Interesting. So, when did you move to America?
For college, so I was probably like 18.
Wow. And where'd you go?
I went to University of Pennsylvania.
Wharton School.
Not Warren. I went to what was it called? The College of, I forgot what they called it. It was like SAS or something, but it was the college, not Warren, not the business
Okay.
school.
Neat. And would you study there?
I studied political science.
Nice lineup for a AI based venture. All right, connect the dots for me. How'd you go from poli sci heading up some AI tech company?
I had no idea what I wanted to do when I was like thinking about majors. I just knew it was fascinating. It was this like first of all, I found like the geopolitical stuff really interesting, and the work in college was all about analyze like reading these long books and analyzing and thinking through my thesis I did on terrorism and just like exploring like what are the different types of terrorism that happened based on the types of government systems that are in place. And I just found all of it just incredibly interesting. Now, if I had known that my career would lead me down to AI, I probably wouldn't have had to go to school because I would have been able to make some very smart investment decisions if I could have seen that 20 something years ago. But it was just something that was fascinating for me.
Yeah. So, okay, again, connect me through. How did you end up on the tech? How did you end up in the tech world?
Yeah, so right after school, I got a job as a management consultant, and it sounded so incredibly glamorous, the way it was framed and positioned, and the way we all thought it, like we thought it meant basically traveling around the world as these 22-year-olds and advising these massive corporations on their strategy. And we all thought we knew what their strategy should be. We all thought we were smart enough to do that. And it turns out what it really was traveling all over the country, basically being away 5 days a week and staying up to like 10, 10:30 at night at the client's office, working on PowerPoint slides and moving little boxes around and just trying to make things like really pretty. And then going back to the hotel and spending 2, 3 more hours moving boxes around on a PowerPoint. And so it was neither glamorous nor interesting, nor were we really doing anything strategic because we were 22-year-olds and knew nothing. But I found it much harder than I realized. It's like it was hard to be away in random cities every week. And it was also just really not a great match with my skills. Like I'm not the most detailed person in the world. And what this job required was like pixel level detail awareness, because really my job was to move boxes on a PowerPoint. I don't mean that in a joking way. Like the partners and the senior managers and like the people on the consulting team would engage in like these incredibly interesting strategic initiatives, and then they would come up with the material and exactly what we wanted to say in the story, and then they would like ask me to put that together in a slide, and it was hard for me. It was not what I was great at. So I started to think really hard about what else I could do, and I started to develop this idea for a business. And one day I just decided to go for it. And so I left to start a tech company. I'd never built a tech company. I knew nothing about building a tech company, but it just felt like there was an opportunity and it sounded like such a better, more interesting path than what I was doing. And so I took a leap. And that was the beginning of it because I learned how to build products. And ultimately that experience got me into business school, which got me a job at Amazon, where I learned like actually how to build in the technology space. And then from there, I started another venture, and that's what I've been doing since.
Very cool. So let's start talking about the back engine AI. First off, voice of the customer. What's that mean? I mean, it sounds cool. Sounds like something that you would put in one of those PowerPoints back in your consulting days.
Oh, for sure. The voice of the customer, it really means that, you know, the idea of going out and collecting the feedback that your customers have, collecting what it is that they're saying. It's like sending out surveys after hotel stay and asking, like, did you enjoy your experience, or net promoter score? Like, how likely are you to recommend this to a friend or a family? Or specific questions about, like, how was your room? Those are all parts of voice of the customer, where you're trying to gather what the customer is saying and what they think and what they feel about your product and your experience. And companies do that because they want to use that information to figure out where they're strong, where they're weak, where they have opportunities, how, where they need to really focus and make things better. And so it's become a big industry with some very large companies that do it. And I was very lucky to spend a couple of years at Medallia, which is one of the big companies in the space, and get a chance to learn about what voice of the customer is. And I think it's fascinating and really powerful.
So one of the things that I run into, and you know, and I'll be honest, I'm a little bit dubious of opinion surveys. I get real nervous around those. And one of the things that makes me nervous is I'm like, who's taking the time to fill these out?
Yep. I don't think you're wrong. I actually think there are several problems with surveys. I think the one you mentioned, like who's taking them out, is absolutely true. There is a bias. You see it in political polling right now, where the skews are so big in terms of, like, who's actually willing to take these polls versus who isn't, that they have to do all this, like, magic wizardry in the background to try and, like, make it representative. And that creates a lot of skew. So 1000%, like, I personally don't take that many surveys. I don't, and like, there is, but there's others. Even if I could get every person to answer a survey, there's a couple of other issues. The first is we are all biased. We were talking about this a little bit earlier, but I can guarantee you with almost 100% confidence that if I ask you how many times in the past year you have been to the gym, you will inflate the number, because it's a natural bias that we all have. We all wish we were working out more, and we all, like, remember those times that we did much more vividly than the days that we didn't. And then if I ask you how many times have you been to McDonald's in the past year, you will almost certainly give me a lower number, the exact opposite effect of going to the gym. And that's true for almost everything we do. If we associate it positively, we're going to inflate it. Negatively, we're going to deflate it. And so that's a big issue when you're asking someone about anything. There's going to be bias built in. The even bigger issue is recall. It's very, very hard for us to remember, like, very important details in our lives, let alone, like, things that don't really matter that much to us. So, like, asking someone after they visited a service or they bought something where they heard it from, and maybe they heard about it 6 weeks ago, like, that might be very important to us because we really care how they heard about us. But the user doesn't care. The user almost certainly doesn't have an accurate recollection of it. And so, to basically ask them, you have the bias of who's actually answering versus who's not, whether they like positively are inflating it or deflating it, and whether they even remember it. And you end up with, you know, not the most accurate data.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. I was talking to somebody earlier today, just this afternoon, and I was talking about a podcast I guested on. I was like, oh, yeah, it posted earlier this week. And then it hit me. I was like, oh, no, it posted yesterday. But
Perfect example.
it's been a couple of days. It's been a busy week. So, you know, 24 hours ago, it feels like days ago.
Yeah. Oh, I know that feeling. That's exactly right. It's hard. It's hard to get that kind of data from someone and get it nice and accurate.
Now, the net promoter score, I don't know a lot about the science behind that, but I know it's a rigorous test. There's apparently some good science behind it. Are you familiar with it?
Yeah, for sure. And listen, I think, you know, it's easy to poke at these methodologies, and no methodology is perfect. At the same time, like in a lot of cases, something is better than nothing. And so I say all that because I actually respect NPS a lot, and I think it is very valuable. But to say that it's not, that it's flawless is just not true. Like one of the famous examples is that if you ask people for to basically do Net Promoter for McDonald's, McDonald's always scores really, really low. And it's not because McDonald's is not well liked. It's just because think about the question you're asking. How
Yeah.
likely are you to recommend this to a friend? Why in the world would you recommend McDonald's to a friend? Your friend already knows about McDonald's. Like, in what scenario? So, yes, the NPS num scores are going to be low, but it's not reflective of whether people like McDonald's or not. So, again, that's not to say it's not good in most contexts. I actually think it is. It's just, it's important to be aware of the limitations.
You know, it's interesting. I was working with somebody a year and a half ago or something like that. And they were talking about doing a survey. And I actually have a blog out there saying how opinion surveys and focus groups are ruining your business. And at one point, I recommended a Net Promoter Score to him. He's like, "Well, Craig, that seems contrary to what you told me earlier." I was like, "Well, no, if you read the article that I posted, what you heard me talk about was sometimes you can use decoys to find the answer you're looking for." And I think the Net Promoter Score is actually a decoy. It's not asking how your experience was. It's, would you
Right.
recommend it to a friend?
Yeah, which I think is part of why it's so powerful.
Yeah. Well, and it's somewhat like, you were talking about the political polling. I know there was a poll that they ran, and I first heard about it in 2016. Which was, of course, was an election that surprised a lot of people. And the most accurate polls, I believe, didn't ask, "How are you going to vote?" They asked, "How do you believe your neighbor will vote?"
Right, because that like fully took out the bias, which is like the thing we talked about before about working out or going to the gym. For like there was negative association with how people perceived they would be perceived based on who they voted for, and so they were less reluctant to be honest, or they just had a bias, the unconscious bias. But when it was someone else, like that goes away. Who cares? So yeah, it makes.
Yeah. So what's the impact? What happens to businesses when they do these opinion surveys? Because I mean, I admire them for taking the time, investing the money to try to get feedback from customers. But what are the risks, and how could that impact businesses?
Well, it's like I have two answers to that, and I'm going to share a car story for each of them. So the risk is you drive off the lot with a car that has a broken speedometer, and you think you're driving at 30 miles an hour, but you're actually driving at 78. What's the risk? The risk is you're going to make bad decisions. If you think you're driving at 30 and you're in a school zone, you're going to get a ticket. If you're like, if you make a turn in the rain, you're going to go out of control. Like, there's a lot of risks to making strategic decisions off of bad data. And so I think that's the real problem and the concern. The flip side of it is, you know, the story about Ford, when I think at some point he said, if I asked consumers what they wanted, they would have told me they wanted a faster horse.
Yeah.
And a lot of people talk about that, and the lesson they learn is consumers don't know what they want. We shouldn't even ask them for it because they don't even know what they want. And I read it differently. I think they did know what their problem was. Their problem was they wanted something faster. They wanted to get to where they were going faster. What they weren't very good at was devising the solution. The solution they proposed was a faster horse. What I take away from this example is, you should ask consumers and you should solicit the information because it is important, but you have to be very, very thoughtful about what you take out of it. You have to make sure that you're understanding like what consumers are good at, where the issues are, and how they respond to these things, and treat it with appropriate enough sort of like understanding of its blind spots. Because if I go back to that first story, I've got a car with a broken speedometer. If I'm positive it's 30 miles an hour and it's 70, that's a real problem. But if I know that the speedometer is broken, then I'm more going to rely on as a gauge, but then I'm also going to look to see how fast it feels like I'm going, and I'll be able to get to a better outcome. And so I think don't rely on it as like the only instrument, but it is an important instrument to have in your collection, at least in my opinion.
Well, and when you were talking about the Henry Ford quote, it also made me think of Steve Jobs, who said, people don't know what they want until we show it to them. And I think
Exactly.
people misunderstood what he was saying there and said, well, we're not going to do research. Well, it came out in a in Discovery, in a lawsuit between Samsung and Apple. Steve Jobs consumed amazing volumes of research. Yeah, he'd pull the customers. But I think it's what you were talking about. He was looking for their pains. He was trying to understand the pains. He knew the customers weren't good at the customers would have never come up with the iPad. They would have never come up with the iPhone. But he was able to figure out the pains and then say, okay, how do we address these pains and come out with amazing products?
Yeah, exactly. That to me, it's all about understanding the strengths and weaknesses of the tools that we use. If we do, I think they're helpful. If we just go in thinking that they're everything, and then we're gonna get ourselves into trouble.
So what does back engine AI do? What does it do and how does it work?
Yeah. So the basic idea around back engine is to do voice of the customer it for businesses that sell to other businesses in a way that doesn't rely on surveys. And the reason is we talked about some of the issues with surveys. In the B2B business to business setting, it's actually not, those aren't the biggest issues. The biggest issue is that most businesses that serve other businesses don't have that many customers, because these are very, very large contracts. And you know, you could be a massive business with 100 business customers. Like, you don't need the thousands, you don't need tens of thousands or millions. So unlike a hotel chain that's servicing hundreds of thousands, if not millions of consumers, and can send out a survey and be okay if only 3% of people respond and still have enough responses that they can draw meaningful insights, a B2B business just doesn't have that big base of employee of customers where they can do that. If they have 1,000 customers, that's a big business, and they send out a survey and they get 30 responses back, I don't know what they're supposed to do with that. And so our approach was to say, okay, just because we can't get enough surveys doesn't mean we shouldn't be collecting customer feedback and voice of the customer. We should. We just have to do it in another way. And when we looked at how B2B businesses operate, they because these contracts are so big and these customers are so important, they actually spend a huge amount of money servicing them. They build out customer success teams and account management teams and sales teams and implementation teams, and all those teams are constantly talking to customers. So there's a lot of engagement, a lot of conversation. And so what we do is we use large language models to mine all of that information and bring it back to the company and bring it back to the rest of the organization, so that they get that voice of the customer without the limitation of having just a small percentage of their customers actually responding, and instead being able to see it across the entire customer base.
So it's, so I noticed when we logged into Zoom, both of our note takers showed up. We didn't let them in the room. But is it like listening to those, listening to those things?
Yeah, as long as they're between the company and a customer and we have the right consents, then yeah, we'll pull that in. So let's say I was your customer and we were having a conversation about how things were going. We would pull that in and we would look to understand, did the customer say anything positive, anything negative? Were there any reactions to the service, to the support, to the product, any feedback? And all of that would get categorized and stored, and then move. This would happen across all the different conversations and all the different emails and all the different interactions, and it all gets basically consolidated into a single place. And then back engine ends up being a suite of dashboards and tools and analysis and reports that the company can run on top of it to understand how are things changing, what are our customers saying, where are we good, where are we bad, what's not working, and so on and so forth.
As a marketer, I would love that. I mean, the so there was a advertiser, famous, very, very famous advertiser named David Ogilvy, and one of his most famous ads was for Rolls-Royce, and the ad read, At 50 miles per hour, the loudest thing you'll hear is the electric clock on the dashboard. And it was wonderful, sold tons of Rolls-Royces. He didn't write that. He went off and spent 3 weeks interviewing owners of Rolls-Royces. And one of the owners just said that. And he's like, I think we'll use that. And it was
Wow.
put right in the customer's language.
That's an amazing story. That's also a really good ad.
And so, I mean, think about that. That was years ago. I mean, cars have gotten a lot quieter in more recent years. This is back when those were noisy, windy, air slipping through the vents and or through the windows. So, could I get that sort of data out of back engine?
Yeah, absolutely. That's exactly it. We collect testimonials. We collect the way people are talking about the product and service in their own voice. But also find the negative stuff, the stuff that you need to know about to fix. So yeah, all of that's fair game.
I love that. I love that because the other thing is when I think there was a lesson from the Industrial Revolution. They spent a lot of money trying to figure out how to make employees more productive, and they took one factory and they increased the lighting. The hypothesis was, more lighting will increase productivity. And so they were smart enough to have their control group and their variation group. And sure enough, the production of the well-lit factory went up. But so did their control group. And what they really learned from that was that when people know they're being measured, they perform differently.
That's an amazing story. That's incredible.
And so when people are doing surveys and what have you, kind of like what you were saying earlier, if you ask them how often they go to the gym, oh, I go 3 times a week. How many times do you go to McDonald's? Oh, only on, rare occasions. Yeah, they know they're being measured, so their behavior changes.
That makes sense. That's awesome. I love that story. I'm gonna borrow that one.
Yeah. Oh, I love this. I mean, I'm fascinated by this tool. How can Ellie, how can people reach you and how can they find this tool?
Yeah, absolutely. The website's probably the easiest place. It's backengine.ai. And you can also email us there, info@backengine.ai. And I'm also on LinkedIn. Should reach out to me there and connect there. And yeah, would love to hear from folks.
Well, excellent. Well, thanks for sharing that on Leaders and Legacies. And I think, as I wrap up, the one thing I would say is you got to find some way to tap in and find the voice of the customer, find out what they're saying. Because if you're not, I mean, I it, it's if you're not hearing it, it will have a cost.
Big one.
Yeah. Well, thanks again.
Thank you. It was so nice connecting with you, and this was really fun. Thanks for having me.
This is Craig Andrews. I want to thank you for listening to the Leaders and Legacies podcast. We're looking for leaders to share how they're making impact beyond themselves. If that's you, please go to alliesforme.com/guest and sign up there. If you got something out of this interview, we would love you to share this episode on social media. Just do a quick screenshot with your phone and text it to a friend or post it on the socials. If you know someone who would be a great guest, tag them on social media and let them know about the show, including the hashtag Leaders and Legacies. I love seeing your posts and suggestions. We are regularly putting out new episodes and content. To make sure you don't miss anything, please go ahead and subscribe. Your thumbs up, ratings, and reviews go a long way to help promote the show, and it means a lot to me. It means a lot to my team. If you want to know more, please go to alliesforme.com or follow me on LinkedIn. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.